So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the scripture passage, but I want to give a shout out to President Reverend David Vasquez Levy. He's the president of Pacific School of Religion, and he was the one that first gave me this insight into this particular passage, so I'm borrowing heavily from him with his permission. Some of you may remember back in October when I sprained my knee. Y'all remember me limping around with a big old brace? Yeah. I don't know if how many of you know what actually happened to cause that, though, because I was a little hesitant to speak of all the details at the time. I was racing my daughter, and I cheated. Yeah, I said that. That's going out on the podcast. Okay, so we were racing down a hallway, and she was winning. We were seeing who could get to the doorway first. It's a long hallway in our apartment complex. We go, it's quite long and curvy. And she got really cocky. And she turned around to me and reached her hand backwards and said, "Mom, why don't you just give me the keys now? Because you know you're going to lose." Oh, so I said to myself, well, if I could just reach forward and grab her shoulder, I could slow her down and shoot past her and win. So I did. And next thing I know, I was face planting into a window at the end of the hallway, because this happened just as we were about to take a corner. We both tumbled. She jumped up. I did not. My leg would not support me. It was not only a fall from dignity, it was a fall from grace, if you will. And for months afterwards, that face print was still on that window. You could see my chin and nose where it had hit. And I not only sprained the heck out of my knee, to the point that I could neither straighten it nor bend it, but I also fractured the bone in between my teeth on my upper jaw. Yeah. So we have 10 lepers coming to Jesus. And 9 of them, they're all healed of leprosy. And yet 9 of them rush off without even saying thank you. And one stays and falls at Jesus' feet and praises God again and again. Scholars have tried to figure out why for so long. Why 10? Why the 9 leave? Why the 1 comes back? What happened there? So let me tell you a little bit about what was going on at that time. At this point, Jesus was on a mission. This story happens in the 17th chapter of Luke, and for the past 8 chapters, Jesus has been on his way to Jerusalem. He says again and again, on his way to Jerusalem, he had his eye toward Jerusalem. He had his face towards Jerusalem, on his way to Jerusalem. 4 times it says that before it gets to this passage, and this passage starts with, on his way to Jerusalem. Jesus was on a mission. He had a one-track mind. He knew what he had to do. He knew how to get there. He was like a rock falling towards Jerusalem. So we've talked a lot about refugees. We've talked a lot about people in transition. And we ask ourselves sometimes, I don't know if you've thought about this, but have you thought about how we orient ourselves in our lives? How do we find our place? We usually orient ourselves with our home. We know where we live. We know our community. We know our house. We have our church to orient us. We have our families and the people we interact with every day. We have our job. This is how we know who we are and how we fit in. So when we hear that there were lepers, we have to recognize that these folks did not fit in. If you look back at the old regulations in Leviticus, they were following them in this passage because they kept their distance. They were required by law to keep a certain distance from people. You know what else they had to do? They had to put their hand over their mouth because they were worried the leprosy would spread by saliva or by coughing. And so they had to walk around wherever they went, keeping a distance from people with their hand over their mouth, shouting, "Unclean, unclean, 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 unclean," wherever they went, so people would know to stay away from them. Can you imagine having to walk around with your hand over your mouth shouting, "Unclean, unclean," everywhere you went? And if leprosy were found on a person, The priest would examine the house, and if they found anything that looked like mold or like it might be related to leprosy, the prescription was to burn down the house. Burn it down. Burn it down. And once you were pronounced unclean by a priest, you could no longer attend temple. Can you imagine having leprosy and being physically isolated from people, losing your home and losing your church community? How do you orient yourself in that situation? How do you know who you are and how you fit in when there is no place for you anymore? So my doctor is a great doctor, but she was less than helpful in this situation with my knee. After the third day when I realized I could not walk on it and I was not getting better, and I had gone to the dentist to get my teeth cleaned, and that's when I discovered, because I told the dentist, be really careful as you're cleaning around this top tooth, it feels a little sore still. And she said, well, let's just take a little x-ray and see what's happening. You know, she took an x-ray and discovered the fracture. And I thought, well, if I did that much damage to my mouth without realizing it, I wonder if I did more damage to my knee than I realized. And I remember the dentist was very sweet. She said, so, you know, just be careful with it. Eat on the other side of your mouth. And if it turns black and falls out, call me. So I went to the doctor. The doctor checked it out. She said, yeah, you sprained it. They did x-rays. There were no broken bones. But by this point, it was puffy and purple. And so she gave me a roll of gauze and said, if you wrap this around, it may help stabilize it, and just stay off of it for 3 weeks and it will be fine. Just stay off of it for 3 weeks. You know, working full time and having two children, I'll just lounge around on my bed for 3 weeks and not move, and it will just get better. That was really hard to do. But there were some little things that came in. Lewis, for example, lent me this totally amazing brace with all these gadgets and gears and straps on it. It looked like something out of the Borg from Star Trek. Put that on there to prevent my leg from straightening or bending. I did a lot of hopping around, which hurt a lot. I did a lot of cruising like toddlers do, where you hang onto the wall and then the chair and then the table to get where you need to go. But every time I hopped, it really hurt. And I started to realize that in order to stabilize ourselves, we have to have two points on the ground, right? Maybe it's a leg and a crutch, but you have to have two, and I only had one. So at one point, I had to go to a meeting down in San Mateo, and I didn't know whether or not the church had ramps or stairs or what have you. So I called David Knopf in a panic, who was also attending the meeting, and asked him if he could bring one of the walkers that I had seen in the church closet. And he did. He brought a walker for me. You know, one of those, it's like, looks like a little, had a little seat on it, and it has little handles, and it's got four wheels, and I could kind of hop forward. It still hurt a lot, but I could do it. Until I realized that it had a little seat on it, and I could move around much more easily if I sat down and scooted. The only problem was the walker has handles that are attached to each other by a piece of metal that's bent. So I could only go one direction. It was really hard to scoot forward. I could only scoot backwards. This is how I moved around, by sitting down in this thing and scooting backwards. So it was at this point that I realized that I couldn't do what I had done before. In fact, I believe that one of our very helpful members, which will remain unnamed, took me aside and said, Tracy, you're no spring chicken anymore. You can't do things like this, like chase your daughter down a hallway. You don't recover as fast as you used to, which I was rapidly starting to understand. It was disorienting to realize that I was, you know, of a certain age. So In the old days, sailors and travelers would orient themselves using three points, themselves and two other. Whenever they were trying to go someplace, this is how they oriented themselves. They knew where they were. They had an identifiable point. They knew the distance between. They could figure out where they needed to go. They could figure out where they were. If they had two recognizable points, they could figure out where they were. So this is how we orient ourselves in our lives, usually. If we have a job and we have a home, we can kind of know where we fit in into our community. And if we are achieving the milestones, which are also orienting, turning 18, getting married, having children, finishing college, getting a job, retiring, all these things, Those will also help orient us in our space and helps us to understand our place, our purpose, our destination, and our path. But how do you orient yourself if you suddenly have to flee your home? If you have to take a new menial position that is a far cry from what you used to do professionally, and if all of your extended family was left behind, how do you orient yourself? How do you orient yourself if your kids move out? You retire from your job, your spouse dies, and you can no longer live in your own home. How do you find your community and how you fit in again? How do you orient yourself if you've been told that in order to lead socially acceptable lives, you have to get a job, get married, have children, and buy a house? But laws prevent you from marrying your partner or adopting children. Student loan debt prevents you from affording a house or qualifying for a mortgage. And all of the entry-level factory jobs have been sent overseas. How do you orient yourself? So nowadays, we use satellites to orient ourselves with GPS systems that connect to the satellites. You know what a satellite is? I mean, we've all heard of a satellite. But do you know what it is? It's just a contraption that has some transmitters on it. And they throw it up in the air as far as they can. And then it falls. And because of the gravity difference up in the stratosphere and the rotation of the Earth, it just falls. It's a perpetually falling doodad. That's all it is. It's a perpetually falling doodad. But with modern technology, that perpetually falling doodad can orient you. And you can, with the GPS device, know where you are anywhere in the world, no matter where you are on life's journey. So at some point around week 3, when I still could not put a lot of weight on my knee and I was using the brace and using the walker to scoot around backwards, I was quite a sight to see. My children decided that they wanted to go bike riding. And Bruce, who many of you have met, decided that this was a good idea also. I did not think it was such a good idea to be biking all around the city of Albany, which has many hills and bumps in it, since my children would be biking and I would be scooting. And they all discussed it and came up with a plan. I was wary of the plan, but they were convinced that if I turned around in the walker and managed to scoot in so that that metal bar was across my stomach, much like a stroller, right? And I was sitting on the seat with my feet sticking out the front, that Bruce could stand behind me and hold those handles and push me around like a wheelchair. But it was not a wheelchair. It was a walker. And it had zero struts and zero padding on those little wheels. And it was the whole thing weighed about 3 pounds. It was just light as air. And they were convinced that he could push and the kids could ride their bikes and we would be able to keep up with them and we would just putt around town like you know, the Cleaver family or something. And it was really, really hard because every time we hit a bump, either I would get jolted or the whole thing would pitch forward. And the first thing, once you get down the block from where we live, there's a huge hill. It was just nothing but bumps and being, you know, throttled forward over and over again to get up and over this hill. And so as we get to the top of the hill, we reached an impasse. I had been lurched forward so many times, and every time I lurched forward, it slammed my leg, which would jar the whole thing, and I would pitch forward, and that little tiny strip of metal, which was covered in foam, would catch me in the stomach, and I would almost slide out the bottom, and then we would keep on going. And the kids are zipping ahead. And so we got right to the top of the hill. And of course, there were a couple of cars waiting at the stop sign as we're about to cross the street. There were like 2 or 3 cars. And so by the time, you know, we went down the little ramp to get off the curb and up over the street was not well maintained, and there was a gigantic chuck hole of some sort right in the middle of it. And we hit that thing, and I lurched forward. And because we were all sort of aware that there were 3 cars waiting and another one coming up the hill, there was a sense of urgency. There was no patiently trying to work our way around the pothole. So Bruce pushed on that thing and tried to jump over it, thunk, 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 and I kept lurching forward and hitting my leg and lurching forward, and the kids were gone. They were a couple blocks ahead at this point, and all the cars are sitting there watching a lady who's clearly in something besides a wheelchair, but definitely having some mobility issues with this huge brace on her leg, being thrown forward over and over and over again. It's quite a sight to see, I've been told. So there are 10 lepers. 10 lepers. 9 of them are Jewish. 1 is Samaritan. And Jesus says, go talk to the priest. Remember he says that? Go talk to the priest. Now this is straight out of the book of Leviticus, because in order to be pronounced unclean, you had to go talk to the priest. In order to be pronounced clean, you had to go talk to the priest. The priest was the one at the temple that could tell you, I don't see any more evidence of leprosy on your body. I'm going to pronounce you clean. You can now rebuild your house, live within the community, and return to the church. All they had to do was go show the priest their new cleansed skin, and they could be fully restored in community. They could find their place again. They had their points to orient them. Church, home, family, community. That fast. That's why they didn't even hesitate to turn around and run towards the priest. That's why, he says, why didn't they come back? Of course they're not going to come back. Why would they? They have a home and a family and a community and a life that has been waiting for them, and all they have to do is get there as fast as they can, and they can have it all back. One stays. And it says this one is a Samaritan. And it says earlier that Jesus was passing through Samaria. Now, Samaria used to be the capital of northern Israel. It used to be the capital. But it was destroyed by the Assyrians several hundred years prior, completely wiped off the map. Most of the people were exiled. And so after many generations, a couple hundred years, King Cyrus of Persia allowed people to return and rebuild their cities. Now, the temple was rebuilt in Jerusalem, but some people did sort of return to this general area. And what they found was a culture clash, because the people who had stayed had been living under Assyrian rule for several hundred years, and their concept of what Judaism was and what the nation of Israel was had changed drastically during that time in their efforts to adapt. They were disoriented, and they had gone in a different direction than all the Jews that had been living in the diaspora, also practicing a form of Judaism, that had to adapt to the local culture there in Persia, in Babylon, in Egypt, and so on. And so when all of these people returned to the people who had stayed, there was a culture clash. There was a power struggle. And the nation of Israel came out on top, and the people that were returning stayed on top, and the ones that had stayed were on the bottom. They were seen as religious misfits, if you will, sort of a separate religious and cultural identity that did not fit with Judaism. And so there was this sort of no man's land between the Sea of Galilee and Judea that they called Samaria, even though there was no Samaritan city anymore. And this is where all of those folks stayed. And that's why you keep hearing them talk about the Samaritans. Like, the story of the Good Samaritan is such a shock, because it was one of these outcasts that did the good deed, and no one was expecting them to do that. They didn't think they were capable of good behavior. And to hold them above all of the priests and the rabbis in that story was a shock. So here's the thing. Here's the thing. This Samaritan had been living as an outcast for most of his life. At some point, he also developed leprosy. So when he was cleansed of the leprosy, it didn't matter if he went back to the priest. He was not allowed to come to the temple because he was not considered part of the religion. He could supposedly go back to Samaria, but for what? But for what? There were leper colonies there, and they were outcasts anyway. He couldn't return to the leper colonies, of course, where he had had his home for quite some time, because then they were contagious and he didn't want to go back there. How do you orient yourself in this? How do you orient yourself in that situation if you only had one place to orient yourself anyway, and now that's suddenly been taken away and there are no others available to you? So now he's suddenly healed. He's suddenly healed, but he's a Gentile. He can't go back to the temple. How do you orient yourself in a situation where you're a foreigner with no community and no church and you've lost your former identity? He comes back to Jesus and he falls at his feet, praising God, and chooses to follow. He attaches himself to Jesus, a constantly moving object, a rock falling towards Jerusalem. That's how he orients himself. Through Jesus, he finds himself cleansed. He finds himself with a new identity. He finds himself accepted and blessed and in a new church with a new path and a new purpose and a destination and community. And this is exactly where we find ourselves when we choose to follow the path that Jesus lays for us. And this is exactly what we offer to those whenever we invite others to join us on this path. Sometimes people, when they're invited, are eager to return home to something familiar that sustained them and sustains them in their life. Some people are so set and so comfortable and unquestioningly settled that they can't imagine disrupting that for anything or for anybody. But for others, for the people that Jesus spent most of his life ministering to, for the displaced and the disoriented, for the shell-shocked and the aliens among us, an invitation to join church community can be a life-saving GPS system to help them rediscover their place, their destination, their path to get there with loving community. And that's what we're striving for when we talk about sanctuary, when we talk about radical welcome, and when we talk about walking together in love. So as I'm sitting at the top of this hill, being lurched forward again and again and again, while a line of cars are staring at this whole spectacle of literally what they said is, I looked like a lady in a stroller. On the one hand, it was jarring. On the other hand, it had taken a heck of a lot of work to get me to that point, and I had overcome so much, and I had other people helping me to get to that point, helping me the whole time to allow me to rest, to heal, to push me up that hill, to get me out of the house, to get me these devices that stabilized my leg and allowed me to be more mobile. But I still found myself extremely frustrated, extremely frustrated. I had had enough of being lurched every time we hit a little bump. I'd had enough of being stared at by the cars. I'd had enough of hitting the same pothole over and over again in the middle of a street. So I said, let go! Let go, I said. And I lurched myself forward onto my good leg with my toe touching the ground with my bad leg, grabbed that chair, which was still attached to me physically. I couldn't get out easily. I lifted it up so it stuck straight out the back of me, and I hopped myself across that street with righteous indignation. Faye tells me that all the people in the cars, which at this point there were five or six in a line, she said every single one of their mouths dropped when they saw me do that. And my mouth dropped too, because I realized how far I'd come. I'd realized that I had more support than I realized. And I realized that I was literally cresting the hill in more ways than one. And it was all downhill from that point, and I had good people with me. And maybe I was quite a spectacle. Maybe I was not what people were expecting to see. I don't think I was what I was expecting to see. But I was okay. I was oriented. I was stabilized. I was healed. And I was supported. Can I get an amen to that?